tombstone, came home to his wife and family after serving in the conflict overseas. And the time that he served had shattered all his nerves and left a little shrapnel in his knee. But the morphine eased the pain, and the grass grew around his brain and gave him all the confidence he lacked. With a purple heart and a monkey on his back, there's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. Little pitchers have big ears, don't stop to count the years. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios. Sam Stone's welcome home didn't last too long. He went to work when he'd spent his last dime, and Sammy took to stealing when he got that empty feeling for $100 habit without overtime. And the gold rolled through his veins like 1,000 railroad trains, and eased his mind in the hours that he chose. While the kids ran around wearing other people's clothes, there's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. Little pitchers have big ears, don't stop to count the years. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios. Sam Stone was alone when he popped his last balloon, climbing walls while sitting in a chair. Well, he played his last request while the room smelled just like death, with an overdose hovering in the air. But life, it lost its fun, there was nothing to be done but trade his house that he bought on the G.I. Bill for a flag-draped casket on a local hero's hill. There's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. Little pitchers have big ears, don't stop to count the years. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and the Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us on accesssacramento.org, or we're at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, and you can friend us on Facebook. Today's program is not a political topic. It's NPR's national correspondent Eric Weiner joins guest host Ted Astrogatti for a discussion of his new book, The Geography of Bliss: One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World.
But you got this bit of advice from your friend named Karma in Bhutan that said...
It's great to meet a man named Karma. I mean, you figure that has to be good karma, you know.
It's going to have a CD out very soon.
Exactly.
Okay. It says, don't live your life with unrealistic expectations.
Yes. Yeah. And he is one of the most remarkable people I met in my travels. He was born in a village in Bhutan. He went on to earn a PhD from Cambridge University in the UK. But he's still very much grounded in his Buddhist beliefs. And he said, don't have unrealistic expectations. He said that's the secret to his happiness. And when he said that to me, I was like, whoa, karma, what are you talking about?
Right.
I mean, certainly you've had expectations. Look how far you've come. And for me, expectations and really ambition has been this engine that drives me and moves me towards career success and towards happiness.
Oh, yeah.
And he was saying, no, that's a bad thing to have. And the problem in the U.S., I think, is when people say don't have expectations or have acceptance, we think of it as resignation. And we think of it as giving up and settling for second best. And I guess it's really a Buddhist belief, but particularly Bhutanese belief, that you don't need to always be striving, and yet that doesn't make it a cop-out either. It's a tricky thing, you know, between acceptance and resignation. Resignation has a sort of negative connotation,
right,
doesn't
right.
it?
I think it's tough for our American minds to get their, you know, to get our mind around it.
Right. But coming from someone who earned a PhD from Cambridge, it sort of meant more to me than coming from someone who had not gone anywhere
right.
in his life. But he had gone so far, and yet he told me that, you know, his secret to happiness was not having high expectations. I can't imagine an American quite saying that.
Well, we look at some of your one, what I call your contrasting country, which was Moldova.
Now you have to pronounce it properly. It's Moldova. See, doesn't it sound melancholy?
Yeah, it really
say?
Does. It kind of sounds like a Seinfeld episode in a way.
Like, how are you feeling today? Really? A bit Moldova.
Jerry, what's going on with you? I feel kind of Moldova, Mom. That sort of thing. Okay.
I can see George saying that.
Definitely.
George, yeah.
Definitely
okay.
George. Okay. And you go there to this country, and you find that in many ways, it's probably one of the most miserable places on Earth.
Well, statistically, that's why I went there, because, you know, Ruth Veenhoven at the World Database of Happiness said this is the least happy country in the world. And, you know, they don't even get up to a 5 on a scale of 0 to 10.
People may not even know where Moldova is.
Okay, it is sandwiched between, it's a former Soviet republic, sandwiched between Romania and the Ukraine, two, by the way, fairly unhappy countries themselves, but not as unhappy as Moldova. Moldova
becomes the magnet of unhappiness.
I guess so. And I wanted to find out, again, in all seriousness, why Moldova is so miserable. I mean, it's a poor country, relatively speaking, compared to its neighbors, but it's not nearly as poor as sub-Saharan African countries or Bangladesh or places like that.
Right.
And so I wanted to sort of figure out, if I could figure out why they were so miserable, it might teach me something about why other countries are happy. And I went there thinking, well, can it really be that miserable? And I can tell you, Ted, with absolute assurance, with my apologies to any Moldovan friends I may or may not have out there, it truly is a miserable
place.
Well,
you know, as I read through that chapter, I found that one of the things that you highlighted that made the place so miserable was certainly corruption. That seems to be a constant there.
Yes.
Lack of altruism among the people.
A lack of trust, really, which
trust.
Goes to both of those things. And that is what I found to be the defining characteristic of unhappy places.
What about bad food?
Not as much as you would think,
yeah.
Or bad weather, and we'll get into that in a minute, I hope, but it's not palm trees and beaches, or, you know, it's not the weather. It's, when I talk about geography, really, I'm talking about cultural geography, right?
Right,
how the
right.
culture, how people get along, and that lack of trust, which is endemic in Moldova, is very corrosive, and envy. I mean, envy is probably the most toxic substance known to happiness. I mean,
people don't trust anyone. You don't trust your family,
they
don't trust your neighbors.
They don't trust their neighbors.
Certainly don't trust the government.
No, they don't. And really, I mean, social scientists have found that it's you know, you take a look at Iraq. I mean, what the country suffers from is a lack of trust. Do people trust their tribes, their family? That's easy. It's trusting strangers. That's the tricky part.
So do you think that this sharpened your sense of what makes the happy
yeah.
society?
I mean, we know everything by its opposite, right? We don't know hot without cold. We can't quite appreciate Mozart without Barry Manilow. These help us understand things. And by going to Moldova and seeing how miserable it is, and again, it's not money. I mean, it is and it's not. And the Moldovans, when I got there, I'd say, you know, I'm here to probe your misery. And they said, well, we're miserable because we don't have any money. I said, well, you're doing better than a lot of other countries in Africa. But again,
right.
they don't compare themselves to Africa. They compare themselves to their wealthy neighbors in Europe.
Okay. And you go to Thailand, which I thought was an interesting
right.
choice, because a lot of people go there for vacations that...
Land of the... Well, those vacations,
those
yes.
kind of vacations, the
yes.
ones that, you know, sort of a wink and a nod. But
it's the Netherlands of Asia.
But you found their philosophy of life quite almost baffling in a way, because it was just sort of like, well, things happen, you know.
My pen lie, which translates roughly as never mind. Again, which we Americans would say in a more negative way, like, oh, never mind, I'll do it myself.
Right, right.
Just never mind. But when they say, the Thai say my pen lie, never mind, they mean literally never mind. Don't mind it. And
don't mind what's happening.
Yeah,
in the world.
Just let it go. You know, I spoke with an American working for the Associated Press there. He's lived there for 35 years, a long time. And he said to me, Eric, I was in a meeting with my Thai office manager. We were balancing the budget of our bureau, trying to get things to work, and we couldn't get the numbers to come out. And this Thai woman, the Thai office manager, said to him, the American, you know, Dennis, that's his name, Dennis, we don't have to solve this one right now. Let's just let it go. And Dennis
said, and he became
it was
very
like
uniquely Thai.
It was like, yeah, you know, I guess we don't have to figure everyone out, every problem out at that moment. And the other thing that really kind of blew me away about Thailand is, you know, they have an expression, and I won't attempt to say it in Thai because I can't, but it translates into don't think too much. Or you think too much, as if thinking were a negative characteristic.
Right.
And they really view it that way. And as an American, I've always thought, and there's that word thought, think, I've always been thought.
I'm right there.
Yeah, I have always thought that my relative lack of happiness was caused by not enough thinking or faulty thinking, and I needed to correct my thinking. But the Thais have a totally different attitude, and their attitude is that you can think too much. You can be too serious, you can think too much, and thinking itself is poisonous to happiness. I mean, the Thais are not a very introspective people, but they're very happy people. I mean, they don't read self-help books, they don't watch Woody Allen movies, and yet they're happy. And that's something, Ted, that I found in my travels, is the countries out there that think about happiness the most or the least happy, the countries that think about it the least or the most happy. So go figure.
I'm speaking with Eric Weiner, NPR correspondent and author of the book, The Geography of Bliss.
Coming up next from the movie Jesus, Sermon on the Plain.
Blessed are you, poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you and reject you and insult you and say you are evil, all because of the Son of Man. Be glad when that happens and dance for joy, because a great reward is kept for you in heaven. But their ancestors did the very same things to the prophets.
That's all I've got.
What do you mean that's all you've got?
How terrible for you who are rich now. You have had your easy life.
He doesn't want to be rich. He must be mad.
How terrible for you who laugh now. For you shall mourn and weep. How terrible when all men speak well of you. For their ancestors said the very same things about the false prophets. But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. And pray for those who mistreat you. If anyone strikes you on the one cheek, let him hit the other one also. And if someone takes away your coat, let him have your shirt as well. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if someone takes what is yours, do not ask for it back again. Do for others only what you would have others do for you. If you love only the people who love you, why should you receive a blessing? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, why should you receive a blessing? Even sinners do that.
How could he touch her?
How could he talk to her?
Disgusting.
No. Love your enemies and do good to them and lend expecting nothing back. And then you will have a great reward, for you will be sons of the Most High God. For he is good to the ungrateful and to the wicked. Be merciful, just as your father is merciful.
Save us, Jesus!
Judge not, and you will not be judged. Condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven.
Lead us in thy path, O Lord.
Give, and it will be given to you. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. One blind man cannot lead another. If he does, they will both fall into a ditch. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but pay no attention to the log in your own eye?
Guide us, O Master.
We need you now, Lord. How happy is the mother that bore you and nursed you.
Rather, how happy are those who hear the word of God and obey it.
I'd like to know this man.
Do you think he might be the Messiah?
You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Ted Asfregatto in for Michael Krasny, who will be back on Monday. I'm speaking with Eric Weiner, NPR correspondent and the author of the book, The Geography of Bliss. Eric, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Iceland. Now, you found a society that was quite lively, communal, tolerant, and massively drunk on the weekends.
Oh, yeah.
And yet they were quite happy, despite the fact that they live a good chunk of the year in an almost sunless existence. So when you look at Moldova, which we talked about as a very miserable miserable place, and Iceland, which on the surface seems kind of miserable, you're living in Arctic weather and it's dark. What sort of contrast can you draw?
I mean, Iceland is one of those unexpectedly happy places, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't expect it to top the list of happy countries, right. And yet it does. I mean, it has the name ice in its word. Right off the bat, that's problematic. That's trouble. It's isolated in the North Atlantic. Mm-hmm. It's a small place with a population of only about 300,000 for the whole country, which is a few city blocks in the Bay Area, I guess, not much more. And yet it comes out as one of the happiest, and I wanted to find out why, and I specifically decided to go to Iceland in the middle of January. And people said, what, are you crazy? It's cold and it's dark. And I was living in Miami at the time, and flying from Miami to Iceland in the middle of January is counterintuitive at best. And so I hopped on an airplane in January, left warm, sunny Miami, and flew to Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland. And it is cold and it is dark. And it is a happy place, though. And there are a number of reasons for it. You alluded to the drinking like fish.
They just get really lit on the weekends.
And they have the reputation for that. So I want to just throw this out there. For research purposes, purposes, I chose to get drunk with them on the weekend and experience Icelanders in their natural state on the weekends.
But you chose the wrong type of alcohol, didn't you? Initially, beer?
Well, it's very expensive in Iceland. Yes. So the average beer is $10, so, you know, each sip's about $1.50, you know. They do drink heavily, but they engage in what I call bracketed indulgence. Mm-hmm. They get sloshed on the weekends, but if you so much as have a sip of wine or beer on a Tuesday or Wednesday evening, you're labeled a lush. And the Icelanders explain this sort of strange behavior as they explain all their strange behaviors owing to their Viking past. These are the sons and daughters, descendants of Vikings. And back in the old days, you know, a few hundred years ago or a thousand years ago, you never knew where your next meal was coming from, the next catch of cod or the next harvest. And so when it arrived, you just devoured it. And so that's the way they are still. They have this binge mentality, and it applies to their drinking and their socializing and their work, too. They're binge workers. They either work like crazy. Back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev held a famous summit in Reykjavik, and the Icelanders had 10 days to put it together, and they were very proud that they did it in 10 days. And I'm sure they got really hammered afterwards.
Yeah, probably.
So they have that sort of notion of bracketed indulgence, and they also – they have a very interesting attitude towards career and life. I met an Icelandic man named Lars, who was about my age, in his early 40s, and he was on his fifth career. I mean, entirely different careers. He was a professional chess player. They loved chess. He was a theologian. He was a journalist, a foreign correspondent like myself. He worked in the construction business, and now he's producing music.
Oh, he was a poet, a poet in Iceland. That's quite an anomaly.
Everyone's a poet.
Right.
They publish more books per capita than any country in the world, and you meet these big hulking truck drivers who write poetry, and you tell them you like it. And anyway, Lars said to me, you know, I know that seems like a strange background, five jobs in five different careers. He said, but in Iceland, this is perfectly normal. They're constantly reinventing themselves, and they have no fear of failure. And I'll go a step further and hazard that they love failure. They embrace it. Now, in this country, we like failure, we say, but only if it's the backstory to someone's success. The author whose manuscript was turned down 17 times, who eventually was published and became a bestseller, the businessman who tried to make it four or five times and eventually made it. So he sits down with his interview on CNN. He can talk about his many failures, but he persevered. But no, the Icelanders actively embrace and wrap their drunken arms around around failure, and they're like, you know, you try it, you fail, it's okay. It's kind of heroic, this notion of heroic failure. And that blew me away, too. And they are very creative people, and their imagination is fired by this land, which is wild. It's just wild, volcanic land. And
it's all constantly shifting.
It is. Yeah. And that, you know, one theory that they talk about energy a lot in Iceland, almost as much as California. And and they talk about the energy affecting them. And reserving judgment on energy, but there's something going on in Iceland, energy, call it whatever you want, that's very positive.
I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
Dragon, fire, fire, burn the world. You're gonna start this revolution.
Strength of the lion stands still, I hear war today, still I hear war.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.